The Door County Pulse podcast is brought to you in part by the Door County Community Foundation, inspiring people to give back, to sustain, and advance the community that we love. To learn more, visit givedoorcounty.org.
Hello, and welcome to the Door County Pulse podcast. My name is Deborah Fitzgerald, editor of the Peninsula Pulse. And today I have a guest, not in the podcast studio, but joining us by phone. And his name is Paul Cohen. Cohen is a professor emeritus in history and the Patricia Hamar Bolt Professor of Liberal Studies at Lawrence University, where he taught with a celebrated career for many, many years. He specializes in modern European history, but has also taught courses on film and history. So welcome, Paul.
Hi.
So now the reason I have Paul on today is he is going to be conducting Bjork London Zoom seminars. So seminars, registration for seminars has opened at Bjork London in Bailey's Harbor, and he has a series of three seminars coming up. The first one, which starts on April 4, is entitled, Is Evil Really Banal? Hannah Arendt and the Question of Genocide. The current war in the Middle East has raised a new and urgent question of genocide, but what does the word genocide mean? When did it first appear historically? This seminar will address these questions through a close reading of Arendt's brilliant and controversial book, Eichmann in Jerusalem, which is also, I know as well, The Banality of Evil. I think that's a subtitle of that book. I tried reading this book last year. I was a fan of Hannah Arendt. She was a New Yorker writer, and Hannah Arendt did a series of articles for the New Yorker, I think it was in 1963. So she did a series of reports on the German Nazi leader Adolf Eichmann in the New Yorker, a series, and those articles began in 1963, and then she wrote her book. So you are going to be guiding readers through that book, I guess through the lens of what's happening today between Israel and Hamas. Is that accurate?
We'll be talking about the book for its own sake, but then I'm sure discussion will turn to that.
Okay. So the book for its own sake. Tell me why this book and why now?
Okay. So Hannah Arendt, actually, she was a German refugee, a German Jewish refugee, left in 1933, came to the United States. And then in, I think, 1960, she attends this trial of Adolf Eichmann, who has been snatched out of Argentina by Israelis to go on trial for his role in the Holocaust. So Arendt is posing the question, what genocide means. She's talking about the genocide of the Jews in Nazi Germany and trying to figure out how it happened through Eichmann.
And now this was, her take on this was incredibly controversial at the time and probably still is today. Why was that?
All right, so she's focusing on one man who was a middle-level bureaucrat assigned to basically the what was known as the Jewish question, and involved first just getting rid of Jews to other places, sending them off. There was discussion of sending them to Madagascar, and Israel was one option. Then this gradually evolves into the final solution. By 1941, and there is a meeting of the German High Command in 1942, at which this becomes the official policy. Hmm. And Eichmann becomes the bureaucrat put in charge of that policy. He's being put on trial in an Israeli court in 1960, and Arendt is asking, what kind of guy was this? And her answer is, he was ordinary. The Israeli court and everyone else watching, this is worldwide, a trial. Everyone's watching expecting this guy to be an evil, sadistic monster, you know, that you see in Indiana Jones film. And he wasn't. He was ordinary. He was unself-aware, okay? She calls him at the end of the book. By the way, she doesn't use the phrase banality of evil until the very end of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Her point is he is what she calls a banal guy.
Which makes it all the more horrific, because it can become systematic. It can become a daily ritual.
That's right. I mean, the real point is that it's as if he's in the middle of a bureaucratic machine with a button, and the machine is there regardless. And he just is the guy pushing the button. Okay? So he doesn't have to be, traditionally evil.
Mm-hmm.
He just has a decent button pusher.
Right. So the implications are that any ordinary person can become evil. I mean, it is evil, could become that. I mean, that to me was the horrific takeaway from that, this profile of an ordinary man who's essentially doing his job.
That's right. And the difference is, it's not like there haven't been people like that throughout history. There are people like that in our daily lives. The difference is that there was an entire administrative machine that he could operate. And this is a condition of modernity. The Romans wanted to exterminate peoples, but they didn't have huge technologically efficient bureaucracy, okay?
Hmm.
So his evil becomes possible only in the modern age.
Interesting. This is a just a little snippet from a Guardian article that I read by Judith Butler, and she's talking about the banality of evil. And she writes, "If a crime against humanity had become in some sense banal, it was precisely because it was committed in a daily way, systematically, without being adequately named and opposed. In a sense, by calling a crime against humanity banal, she was trying, Hannah Arendt, to point to the way in which the crime had become for the criminals accepted, routinized, and implemented with moral revulsion and political indignation, without moral revulsion and political indignation and resistance." So it's almost, as you just said, there was no system in place historically for something like this to happen. But today, we have that system.
That's right.
We have that system in place. But we also have in place, through social media and how we have become so global, the opportunity to express moral revulsion and political indignation. And resistance.
That's right. I mean, we have people are watching. Okay, that's very imperfect. People are watching, and they're misinformed. There are people who have, let's say, evil intentions and disinformed people. But the truth is that in Nazi Germany, no one was watching. Nobody knew about this. By the way, the word Holocaust was post-war. The notion of an entire people being exterminated was not current while it was happening, because there was a war, and nobody knew what was going on in the middle of the war. My father was captured at the Battle of the Bulge in 1944 and placed in a camp, a special labor camp for Jewish soldiers. And when he came out, he was interviewed. The camp was connected to Buchenwald, which was one of the major concentration camps. But he didn't know anything about that. He knew, of course, that Hitler was a radical anti-Semite and doing awful things. But the notion of an actual order to exterminate a people was unknown except for inside the Nazi bureaucracy.
And that kind of gets back to the point of, if it's not named and opposed. I mean, it can't be opposed if it's not named. You have to name it before you can adequately oppose it. So when you look at, for instance, Israel versus Hamas, in Gaza anyway, there are 31,988 people killed to date, 74,188 wounded. 82% of the region's total population has become internally displaced refugees. Is that genocide?
There are a couple of ironies here. Genocide, the term was invented in 1944 to to describe what was going on in Nazi Germany. So the original genocide was of the Jews. Historians will then go backward and look for other events that approximated it. But the original genocide is what the Nazis did to the Jews. Hmm. Now, in Israel, the question has been raised. And, you know, it's a hot question. And the word is a hot word. And my first impulse about that is to be skeptical. Because when a word becomes kind of a political football, it gets thrown back and forth. Hmm. So now it's very common on college campuses in the United States to throw that football at the Israelis. And then the Israelis throw it back at Hamas, which is explicitly genocidal. Its purpose is to eliminate Israel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the question becomes, for me, is there an actual desire to eliminate an entire people? And I would say, no. What we have is an occupation. We have a war. We have many people being killed. But to my knowledge, and I don't know what's going on inside the Israeli government, there is no policy to eliminate the Palestinians in Gaza. What's happening isn't horrible and evil. I think it is, but I'm not sure if I would worry about it quite yet. It's closer. As Netanyahu is in power, it's a possibility.
So now this is not the first time that Israel and Hamas, of course, have been at war. This is actually the fifth time since 2008. Of course, the other wars lasted 50 days or less. And, you know, we are now on almost 6 months. But if Israel's desire to eliminate Hamas, which is a group of people,
yes,
then it kind of fits that definition.
Hamas is an organized militia, not an ethnic. It is the Palestinians, but others, not just Palestinians, many others. And
sure.
Its purpose to eliminate Israel.
But it doesn't have to be an ethnic group. It can be a racial, political or cultural group, according to the strict definition of genocide, anyway.
Well, in any case, I would say that any policy to eliminate Hamas is not just in Gaza. It's in Lebanon. It's in Iran. It's in Qatar. So this is not going to happen. The idea of eliminating it, if you want to go there, is the Israeli response to Hamas's idea of eliminate Israel. And this is why I'm not comfortable throwing the word around. Every attack on any people becomes genocide, and then you ratchet up the hostilities, and then you can't talk.
Hmm.
So whether or not the historical measuring stick would be the Nazi genocide of the Jews, okay, I don't think what's happening in the Middle East on either side is anywhere near that. But the purpose might be, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And as you swore, everybody's watching.
Right. And the intention has to be considered as well.
Yes, as I say, the purpose. Why I'm hoping that Netanyahu is pushed out of power in one form or another. His probable replacement, Benny Gantz, has been on record saying he supports a two-state solution. Netanyahu does not. So if you want to call the Israeli government genocidal at this point, yes, Netanyahu is. You know, Netanyahu is actually a self-serving politician who knows that as soon as the war ends, he's out of office. So that's where my hostility is.
Okay.
Toward this man who is corrupt and self-serving.
Now, we started talking and got off a little about the controversy of Hannah Arendt's book. And
yes.
So we were just, you know, touching upon what exactly she meant by that. Why was that so controversial at the time, and maybe even today?
Okay, so first of all, I'm going to talk about what she meant by that. She did not mean that Eichmann was blindly following orders. She did not mean that there is an Eichmann in all of us. These are the kinds of cliches that came out after the book.
Okay.
What she meant was Eichmann was peculiarly unable to imagine things from anybody else's point of view. He was not a stupid man. He was a man who didn't have his own thoughts. He was a community guy. He was a joiner, okay? And he liked being in the Nazi Party because it gave him meaning, but he had no ideas of his own. Hmm. And that's what she meant. All right. Arendt is very sensitive and harsh on cliches. And in her view, and I think rightly, Eichmann was a living cliche. He could barely open his mouth without uttering cliches. Hmm. And, you know, what's a cliche? It's a shortcut that allows us not to think.
So then he was basically, she meant in another way, incapable of original thought?
Yeah, for the most part. He was a company man. You know, think of a corporate bureaucrat doing exercises. My wife, who has worked for KC for 20 years, hated these exercises in which everybody kind of mouthed the company line. Okay, that's who Eichmann was. He was the company line. There are people like that everywhere, but that's not to say everyone is potentially an Eichmann. Mm-hmm. Many of us are capable of original thought and don't live constantly according to cliches.
So she didn't mean that this was potentially anybody who just does their job without thinking.
That's right. She didn't. And also, the other cliche is that he was just following orders. That's not true. He loved following orders. That made him feel good. It made him feel part of the larger movement. Hmm. He didn't need that. He didn't need to be forced. In other words, his mentality was more unique than that, you know, less common than every man, but still more common than you would think. And if you want to exterminate a people, you need guys like that.
Hmm. Why was that controversial?
Because, you know, with the Israelis, one, she's sitting there in the court watching this whole thing. And, you know, this was a series of articles for The New Yorker originally. Then she collected them. The Israeli court wants this to be a show trial, and they want Eichmann to be an evil anti-Semite, and they want to connect the Holocaust, the final solution, to all of anti-Semitism before. Hmm. And she, you know, this is a unique case. She calls it administrative massacre, and she's saying that this guy was, again, an ordinary guy. And Eichmann himself claimed throughout the trial that he had nothing personal against the Jews, mm-hmm. which is horrible and hilarious. Eichmann in Jerusalem that I love, that makes it horrifying, is how funny it is. She's ironic throughout. She pokes holes in everybody's bullshit, if you excuse me.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
she's got a very good bullshit meter. And she pokes holes at the Israeli court, at the then-current German government, and at Eichmann, and throughout. I always say when I teach the book that I wouldn't want her judging me. She's brilliant.
She is. I have to say that. I mean, I think that I am up for challenging material, but I tell you, when I cracked her book, she is just unbelievable. Not only does she write unlike anybody I have ever read, but she is, you know, truly a philosopher. You will reread sentences, you know, over and over, really trying to understand what she's saying. And then when you get it, it's almost like explicating a poem when you finally get the meaning and deconstruct what she just wrote, you know. So I want to say she is challenging, but it really is quite brilliant. And that would be horrifying to have her write something about me.
There are a lot of oh my God moments in this book, and in order to understand them, you have to get her tone, mm-hmm. which is typically sarcastic and ironic. So lots of times when you read a sentence and you take it straight, you're not going to get what she's saying.
Hmm.
She says at some point, she's talking about the fact that in Nazi Germany, good and evil were reversed, that what we think of as Judeo-Christian morality is reversed because what is moral, what is good and right, and Eichmann is a perfect example of this, is what the Fuhrer said. People, she says, want to be good, but being good by Nazi definition is the reverse of what we would ordinarily think. So their consciences are challenged. And at some point, she says, that people are doing things that they know is wrong, but they do it anyway, and they feel fine about it. She says this in much more ironic and eloquent ways than I
do. Was that, were people just not able to capture her irony or her sarcasm? Did that make it so controversial?
Partly. They misread her. The whole notion of the banality of evil became the only thing that people saw.
I see.
The book is in some ways directly about Eichmann and the trial, but in some ways it's about the larger historical context of the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
She's things in there about, this is the other thing that's controversial. You have the banality of evil thing, which becomes itself, ironically, a cliche.
Mm-hmm.
And she tries to explain what she meant. There's an epilogue in which she goes into that. But the other thing is a fairer response to her, a fairer attack on her. Over the course of talking about what happened in the Holocaust, you have in Germany and the occupied territories, Poland especially, there were 2 million Jews. And how do you organize 2 million Jews in order to kill them? Well, there were what was known as Jewish councils or Judenrat, okay? That is, the Nazis go to the Jewish community and they say, okay, we need to talk to you and we need lists of names and occupations and so on in order to organize the community. By the way, for anybody who's seen Schindler's List, Stern, the main Jewish character, is the head of the local Jewish council.
Okay, so you're talking about Schindler's List, right? You faded out just a little bit there, but you said Schindler's List, correct?
The Schindler's List and the character of Stern, who is the guy doing Schindler's bidding, his role is head of a Jewish council. And what Arendt says is that without the Jewish councils, the Nazis couldn't have killed as many as they did.
Mm.
And that, in effect, the Jewish councils are become part of the Nazi bureaucracy.
That's right.
Now, this is accurate in a literal sense, but unfair historically, because people in the Jewish councils did not know what was going on any more than my father did, okay? In the moment, they just thought that they're trying to save as many Jews as they can, so they'll cooperate with the Nazis in order to do that.
Mm.
Arendt didn't make that distinction clear, and she was attacked for that, and I would say rightly so, and she did kind of try to clarify it later, but I think that that's an instance of a lack of historical empathy on her part.
Okay. When you say any more than my father did, what did you mean by that?
I mentioned earlier that my father was captured, was a Jewish soldier captured at the Battle of the Bulge. And he was put in a work camp that was associated with a concentration camp. And he didn't know. He didn't know that, he was in the middle of the war. He was captured in 1944, and people didn't know at that point. And when he was drafted and so on, he actually volunteered. He knew that there was Jew hatred, anti-Semitism, but he didn't know about concentration camps and the Final Solution.
Okay. Did you happen to see the movie Hannah Arendt? I think it came out like...
I did.
Okay, 2012. I thought it did do some correction along those lines because we got to see these Jewish leaders and kind of their ignorance in terms of they thought, they were helping their people instead of sending them to the slaughter. Did you see it that way? It was kind of a correction?
I don't remember it as well as you do, because I remember that the portrayal of Hannah Arendt, I thought, was pretty accurate.
Yeah. Okay.
And her close friend, Mary McCarthy.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I remember from the film. But I don't doubt that the film, you're probably right about that. I think that was the weakest thing in Arendt's argument, that thing about the Jewish Council.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they humanized them quite a bit. I mean, there was the dawning upon them. The one of the characters I remember that finally understood what was happening, and that might not be historically accurate. It might have been done, for dramatic purpose. But
I mean, it might be both. I teach a course on history and film. You mentioned that.
Yes,
I taught it on site at Bjorklund last fall. And, you know, one of the things that people do with historical films is they say, well, it's not accurate, so it's, you know, it's just a drama. Actually, it can be both. Mm-hmm. It's not specifically accurate, but it expresses a historical truth. As a historian, that's fine for me. It doesn't have to be accurate.
Now, what can this book tell us today? Why is this book relevant for what's happening today? Or does it have to be?
Well, I'd say it doesn't have to be, but it is relevant. It's on its own still the most brilliant account of how the Holocaust could have unfolded. And it's one. And when the word genocide emerges, it's there in 1944, Arendt is calling attention to the genocide was officially recognized in 1948 as a thing. The word is in 1944. The United Nations Genocide Convention in 1948 is when it became a thing. And it was specifically aimed at the Holocaust. That's where it started. Okay. The book then is a kind of baseline against which to measure claims of genocide. And the United Nations has thereafter been, you know, where you go if you want to say, well, us, you know, this is a genocide. And there are examples of Pol Pot and Cambodia, clearly genocidal, okay? And then there are more ambiguous ones. I think that Arendt's book can be used as a measuring stick. It doesn't have to be as horrific as the Final Solution to be deemed genocidal, but it can be. What I don't like is people who throw the word around without knowing anything about the history. Mm-hmm. Okay. And Arendt identifies and lays out the history. And for that reason, I think it's very relevant.
Okay. It could be that somebody who throws the word around, genocide, you say, is a politically loaded word. Can it only be used after the war is over?
No, I think that you can ask if a nation or has genocidal intention. You mentioned that before, and I agree with that. And I have to, in all honesty, when this first started, the October massacre that Hamas perpetrated, the original response to that by the Israelis, I don't think was genocidal. It was the way any people would respond if they were attacked like that.
Retaliatory, as the United States understands.
Biden, by the way, for what it's worth, I think has told the Israelis immediately not to overreact. Mm-hmm. And I think the overreaction has increasingly become, well, there are some people in the Israeli government, Netanyahu is defense minister. There's some genocidal anti-Palestinian, anti-Arab, anti-Muslim people in his government. And those people want to eliminate the possibility of a Palestinian state. And to that extent, their intentions are genocidal. Mm-hmm. Is that being carried out? Right now, I'd say it's ambiguous because it's still in the realm of a response. Well, we have to wipe out Hamas, so this will never happen again to us. But I do think that the longer this goes on, the more accurate it would be to call it genocidal.
Do we have any Hannah Arendts today, living, writing, looking at things?
You know, you mentioned Judith Butler.
Yeah.
One of my philosophers, someone else with a good bullshit meter. You know, I think that we have people as brilliant as Arendt. Are they watching and analyzing and philosophizing on her level? I don't know. You know, as you say, things have changed. Social media is everywhere. Mm-hmm. It's hard, you know, as an academic and a boomer, it's hard for me to judge. But I do think that reading Arendt is still, if you read and think the way she does, you'll get much further in understanding how things unfold. Now you'd have to take it. Now part of that unfolding is very much what's being done with social media. I think if Arendt were alive today, she'd be looking at that.
All right. Well, Paul, I'm going to leave it there because I want anybody who wants to explore this more in depth can sign up for your Zoom webinar. And that is April 4th through May 2nd. So how many different classes is that?
That's every Thursday at 2 o'clock for an hour and a half. And by the way, I don't do lectures. I do discussions. So anybody taking the class, we will read the book in small enough chunks to digest them, and then we'll talk about it.
Okay. And so that is that particular seminar is Evil Really Banal, Hannah Arendt and the Question of Genocide. And then you're doing two others. One is The Birth of Fascism. That starts on May 9 and runs through June 6. And then this one, which is really interesting to me, is Civilization Good for Us? Nietzsche, Freud, and Their Discontents. And that one starts July 18. That definitely takes me back to undergraduate days for sure. So those sound like really excellent ways to spend an hour and a half every Thursday, if you ask me. And I may be signing up for your Hannah Arendt class because I don't know that I totally absorbed her. I probably did just skip over some of those sentences that I just couldn't quite grasp. So it would be interesting to read it, you know, much more closely.
I'd love to have you. And you'll notice that I gravitate toward happy subjects.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't apologize for that, but those are the things, actually, to put it differently, I gravitate toward brilliance. Mm. Nietzsche, Freud, Hannah Arendt, this kind of mind attracts me. And what I do as a teacher is try to bring that brilliance down to earth, make it accessible.
All right. Well, you can sign up by going to Bjork London's website. There are places there where you can sign up online for these classes. Paul, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been an interesting discussion.
My pleasure, and I hope to see you in the Arendt Seminar.
Absolutely. All right, and you're listening to the Door County Paul's Podcast, and I want to thank you all for listening again. Until next time.
Thank you for listening to the Door County Paul's Podcast. This podcast is produced by Miles Danhausen Jr. and edited by the Grammy Award-nominated Hans Christian. If you enjoyed this episode and you want to check out more of the podcast, visit doorcountypulse.com/podcasts to find our archive of more than 500 episodes featuring local movers and shakers, characters, business owners, authors, musicians, and everyone who helps make this community that we love.